Since we're just about a month into a new school year, I'd like to take an opportunity to do a short series of messages, especially geared toward our student-age population here. And not a lot this morning, but maybe next week, right? Better weather. It's my hope that these messages will awaken in each of us a desire for the movement of God in our lives, and that they will motivate us to seek the release of God's power then through our lives. So for the next 3 weeks, we're going to take a look at three ordinary teens who face some pretty significant problems. And what I hope is going to happen along the way is that we will be able to identify with their struggles and then learn from their victories. As I said, these are just ordinary teens, people like you and me. But what sets them apart is their faith in an extraordinary God. That is the key to their success over the problems they face. And so the big lesson that I don't want any of us to miss is that God can be trusted to see us through whatever life throws our way. That's the big lesson. God can be trusted to see us through whatever life may throw our way. As we're all aware, life can be very unkind at times. But I also want to remind you that God is bigger than anything that we will ever encounter. And as we choose to exercise faith in Him, we will experience victory in the midst of trying times. Again, while my primary audience for this series is going to be our student age population, I am confident that the truths I will be presenting will be applicable to each of us regardless of our age. I'm going to make just one final comment before launching into the heart of this message, and that is, throughout this series, I'm going to be using the same outline as a template for the message. So if you're taking notes, the four main points are: one, overwhelming odds or the difficult situation. Then we're going to take a close look at the ordinary teen who is faced with the situation. Third, we will focus on the unshakable faith of the ordinary teen. And then finally, we'll see how an extraordinary God responds to this exercise of faith. And if you have a bulletin, you can see these points are printed on the back of it. The first ordinary teen we're going to consider is a young man named David. And the life lesson that we can learn from him this morning has to do with defeating the giants in our lives. The event we're going to look at is found in 1 Samuel 17. We won't read every one of those verses, but if you want to open there, we're going to look at some selected verses through there. So let's get right in. We'll begin by looking at the overwhelming odds that David was confronted with in his particular situation, and we find that there are three that stand out. The first was the Philistine army. Look at verses 1 through 3. It says, "Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Soko in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes-Damim between Soko and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line between the Philistines. So the Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another with a valley between them." Now these verses don't tell us a lot about the Philistine army, but what we know from earlier chapters here in 1 Samuel and from a study of the historical data is that at this time, the Philistine army was stronger and technologically more advanced than the Israelites. And the greatest advantage that they had was that they possessed iron weapons. They were in control of the territory, and they had denied the Israelites the opportunity to have iron weapons. They forbade them from having any blacksmiths to forge iron implements of any kind. So if they needed some blacksmithing done, they would have to go into the Philistine cities in order to get this done. We're told in 1 Samuel chapter 13, verses 19 through 22, that the only exceptions to this no iron weapons rule was Saul and his son Jonathan. They were the only ones who had swords. So you can take a look at this and say that in practical terms, this means that the rest of the soldiers in the Israelite army were equipped with repurposed farming implements. They took their hoes and their sickles and refashioned them for war. And so you can see right off the bat, this is not going to be a fair fight. Second overwhelming odd that David had to face was this single figure named Goliath, who again becomes the central figure here along with David in this incident. We read in verses 4 through 10, a champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span, which translates into over 9 feet tall. He had a bronze helmet, and on his head he wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and his iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will be your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will be our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight to each other." Goliath is described as a champion or great warrior. And I'm told that during this period, a champion, as described here, refers to a middleman, that is, a person who, on the part of his own people, undertook to determine the national quarrel by engaging in a single combat with a chosen warrior from the hostile army. So in other words, instead of everyone engaging in the heat of battle, you could opt to have one representative from each army step out onto the field of battle and settle it in a middle mini battle. Kind of sounds like a video game, doesn't it? Something there. Anyway, this mini battle then would expedite the process, and then it would save a lot of potential casualties. Goliath is also described as a giant, as I said, over 9 feet tall. Now, I'm sure that we have seen basketball players who step out onto the court in the 7-foot-plus range and we're awed by their size. Perhaps some of us have even had the opportunity to stand next to one of these giants. Well, can you imagine an additional 1.5 feet above that 7 or 2 feet above? And so, put it in perspective, the 7-foot center would have to look up to see Goliath and be awed by his presence. Goliath was huge. The average height of a soldier in the Israelite army would have been around the 5'4" range. And so we're talking about a guy who was almost twice as tall as the average Israelite. But that's not all. Goliath was also an experienced warrior who was well equipped with the latest in Philistine weaponry: shield, sword, javelin, chainmail, etc. And he issued the challenge to the Israelites 40 consecutive days. Send out a man and let's settle this quickly. Let's move on to the inevitable outcome. I mean, is there any doubt what is going to take place eventually? Is there any doubt who is going to win? Why waste so many lives? Can you imagine 40 days, 40 nights, twice every day, send out a warrior, let's get this over with? Pretty formidable odds. But David had one other force stacked against him. And the third overwhelming odd was the fear-struck Israelite army. Verse 11 says, on hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Skip down to verse 24. Whenever the Israelites saw the man, they all fled from him in great fear. Let me summarize the situation. Saul and the Israelite army are not going to be any help to David. They're all looking for a place to hide. They're all hoping that there's a hero who is going to emerge who will deliver them from certain defeat. For 40 days, 9 foot plus Goliath comes out twice a day to taunt Israel's soldiers who respond by shaking in their sandals before his seeming invincibility. Now, if you know anything about the choosing of Israel's first king, who is Saul, then you may recall that one of the attractive characteristics of Saul was that he was head and shoulders above everybody else. So you start to do the math here, and you can't help but come to the conclusion that the most likely candidate to succeed against Goliath was the king. But where do we find the king? Guess what? He can do math too. And he is running and hiding. He wants nothing to do with this. He's probably fretting over the fact that he is going to be called out and have to stand up against this Philistine bully whose cries, "Send out your best man!" And in my mind, I imagine every time Saul heard the challenge, he looked around and he asked, "I wonder who that could be." You know, he wants nothing to do with this. So the net result of this standoff is that Goliath wins a TKO twice a day for 40 days. Those are the odds facing little David. So let's turn our attention then to the ordinary teen named David. Who was he and what were the circumstances surrounding his life? Just to put this in a historical context, this event took place probably around 1025 BC. We learn from the scriptures that David was the youngest of 8 sons. His father, Jesse, was well advanced in his years. As this story, if we came into the beginning of the story, we would see that David had served his father as an envoy, bringing food to the 3 elder brothers who were serving in Saul's army. Vocationally, David was a shepherd. And shepherds were the lowliest occupation there was. David was known as a great musician on the harp. He was enlisted by Saul to play for him whenever evil spirits tormented him. David was probably between the ages of 15 and 17 when this event takes place. And from a natural standpoint, the only outstanding thing we could attribute to David's credit was that the prophet Samuel had anointed him to be the next king of Israel. However, there was no evidence that that would ever come to fruition. It was this odd incident that left everybody shaking their heads, wondering if Samuel really knew what he was doing, if he really knew what he was talking about. So everyone who knew David saw him pretty much the same way. He was just an ordinary teen with very little to offer against the Philistine champion Goliath. I'm going to skip down a little bit here. Those are the odds that David is facing. He also has some problems with his brothers who are envious of him. I won't read all that section there. And then his encounter with King Saul. King Saul doesn't have much hope for him being able to do much either, but allows him to take a chance anyway because then he doesn't have to. So we've considered these overwhelming odds and we've got a picture of who David is. Now I want to turn our focus on David's unshakable faith. And I want to begin by giving you a very practical definition of unshakable faith. This is what I mean by it. Unshakable faith is the natural byproduct of an abiding relationship with God. Unshakable faith is the natural byproduct of an abiding relationship with God. David's unshakable faith was not some special endowment that came upon him in that particular moment. It's not like what we read in 1 Corinthians, the gift of faith. That's not what we're talking about. Rather, it was this growing reality that he had acquired as a result of an abiding relationship with God. You see, a vital relationship with God gives us the ability to see things from God's perspective. David was not merely looking at the circumstances surrounding him from an outward, natural vantage point. Instead, he chose to look at things through the eyes of unshakable faith, which allowed him to ask this: God, what do you see when you look at this situation? What do you see when you look at this situation? And then the faith goes further and says, I want to see it that way too. That is unshakable faith. How did David exercise unshakable faith in the vortex of these overwhelming odds? He expressed it in two ways. First, David began by rehearsing God's faithfulness to him in the past. Look at verses 34 and 35. It reads, "But David said to Saul, 'Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by the hair, struck it, and killed it.'" Wow. He had conquered both the lion and the bear in past encounters of while tending his father's sheep. And what David realized is that he wasn't victorious simply because he was so strong in himself. It wasn't due to his swiftness. And it wasn't because the lion and bear just happened to be off in their game a little bit that day and he got the upper hand. Not at all. He knew that he overcame them because God was working in and through his life in those moments. He sensed God's enabling for the task. And what he surmised from those experiences of God's faithfulness in the past was that doing battle with Goliath would be no different than it was with those animals, because it was God who won the victory. And on the basis of what God had done in the past, David then took confidence in God's continued faithfulness in the present and in the future. Let's continue reading in verse 36. "Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord, who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine." In this passage, we see the epic contrast of faith. It's the epic contrast of faith. Goliath, he's standing on one hill. And what did he trust in? He trusted in his skill. He trusted in his strength. He trusted in his training. He trusted in his weapons. He trusted in his experience. I got all this. While David, standing on another hill, placed the whole weight of his trust for victory upon God, whom Goliath had defied. David, and I want you to get this. David clearly understood that success did not rest in military prowess or in strength or his intelligence or his speed. Those are good things, but what he was trusting in, what he was resting in, was God's power. The battle was the Lord's. And that day, David's unshakable faith allowed him to see that he was simply going to be used as the weapon that God would wield to defeat the giant. Wait and see what God does. That was his attitude. And now we come to the climax of the story. And this is the part where an extraordinary God rewards an ordinary teen for his unshakable faith in the face of overwhelming odds. As most of us already know, God comes through just as David believed. But I want you to notice the three ways that God responded to David's faith. The first and most obvious way that God responded to David's faith was that he did enable him to defeat Goliath. This is what we read in 48 through the beginning of 51. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sunk into his forehead and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with the sling and stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. David ran and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from its sheath. After he killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. What a victory. The outcome of the battle was just as David predicted. He told him, "You come out here against me with your sword and your spear, and I'll come against you in the name of the Lord, and here's what's going to happen. I'm going to take you down, and I'm going to cut off your head. And furthermore, your whole army will be routed this day." As we just rehearsed this well-known story, again, I want to warn each of us not to let its familiarity blind us to the fact that David entered into this battle without any guarantees of an easy win. I think sometimes we forget that. We just think, oh, we know how it turns out. David just knew it was all going to be fine. No. I mean, he didn't take 5 stones with him for nothing. If it was going to be easy, he only needed one, right? But he picked up 5. I might have to dodge a little bit here today. I don't know. In fact, he didn't have a guarantee of a win at all. David was simply a man. He was this ordinary teen who was convinced that God was going to do something, that God was going to reward his faith, that God was not going to let him down. That's what he knew. And so, with unshakable faith, he ran into the fray, and God won the victory. I'll make a couple of comments about true faith, as opposed to the type of faith that is oftentimes touted in popular Christianity. It's important to understand that you don't always have to hear a sure word from the Lord before you can step out in faith. So many times we want to have all the details before we take a step. I'm here to tell you that oftentimes, in fact, more often than not, faith has more to do with an innate responsiveness to an acquired knowledge of God than to receiving this unique message from God before acting. Faith is an expression of God's character in action through his children. It's simply moving in a confident awareness of who God is and what he would likely do in the current situation. That's why I defined unshakable faith as a natural byproduct of an abiding relationship with God. See, when we really get to know God intimately, then we're able to move boldly and even effortlessly according to the rhythms of his heart. We will see that this is not only true of David in this situation, but also true of the ordinary teens that we'll be looking at in the coming weeks. And I believe that this is the purest expression of faith. Just walking out and believing in God and holding his hand and allowing him to move you where you need to go. Second way that God responded to David's faith that day was to enable the Israelite army to defeat the Philistine army. It wasn't just Goliath who fell that day, but the whole army was routed. You can read those verses on your own, starting verse middle of 51 there. I mean, it was a complete turn of events. Nobody saw this coming. Nobody but David. That terrified band of men with nothing but retrofitted farming implements was empowered by God to defeat a superior army equipped with swords and shields and spears of iron. Friends, that was God. And that is our God. Third way God responded on behalf of David's faith was to cause him to be esteemed by all. I want to read just the first few verses from 1 Samuel 18. It said, after David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return home to his family. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off his robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. Whatever mission Saul sent him on, David was so successful that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the troops and Saul's officers as well. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King David with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with timbrels and lyres. And as they danced, they sang, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. An ordinary teen, the youngest of eight, a shepherd, a nobody. Wrong. Somebody. Somebody. Why? Because of his unshakable faith in an extraordinary God. The giants that you and I face will probably not be the physical kind that confronted David. But they are giants nonetheless. They are still threatening, frightening, seemingly unconquerable, constantly coming against us, and they appear certain to destroy us. When we encounter them at school or on the bus or on our jobs or whenever we're alone, we can take courage that we are not the first ones to face them, and that others have been able to defeat the giants in their lives. Friends, all is not lost when the giants show up. We have an extraordinary God who delights in rescuing us and making us victorious. Perhaps you're facing a giant of some kind right now. Maybe it's a person. Maybe it's circumstances. Maybe it's doubt. Maybe it's an illness. Maybe it's a concern about the future. Whatever the giant may be, let David's response to his giant be an encouragement and example to you. You don't have to face the giant alone. In fact, that is the very worst possible thing that you can do. Instead, follow the path that David took. Present your case to God. Place your faith in God and expect God to respond to you and your exercise of faith as a father who delights in giving good gifts to his children. That's who he is. Remember, God is still the same today. The same God David believed in is right here, right now. He is active, he is alive, and he is mighty to save. He can still be trusted. Give him the opportunity to demonstrate that he's still in the business of defeating the giants today.